The story of life, well, it's full of these huge evolutionary jumps. But maybe the biggest one, the most profound, is that leap from simple prokaryotes to complex eukaryotes, you know, the cells that make up you, me, everything we see.
Absolutely. And today we're diving into that history, which goes back, what, at least 1.8 billion years. We're using a really great deep dive from Dr. Ty C.M. Hoffman as our guide here.
Right. And the goal is to kind of quickly get our heads around the major steps, like how did complex cells get their key parts? And how did that basic structure just, boom, unlock all this incredible diversification we see?
Yeah. And Dr. Hoffman focuses not just on, say, animals or plants, but the evolutionary innovations that made all complex life possible, including those often overlooked guys, the protists.
Okay, so where does Dr. Hoffman start? What's the fundamental thing that separates us eukaryotes from the prokaryotes we came from?
It really boils down to the internal scaffolding, the cytoskeleton. See, a prokaryote, like a bacterium, it's pretty rigid structurally.
Right, rod shape, sphere shape, that sort of thing.
Exactly. But eukaryotes, we have this incredibly complex, dynamic internal network. Microtubules, microfilaments.
And that structure, that's the engine, because it lets the cell membrane change shape drastically.
Precisely. It allows for rapid major changes in cell shape. Dr. Hoffman had this great image, remember, a big brown eukaryotic cell literally wrapping around and swallowing a smaller teal prokaryotic cell.
Yeah, phagocytosis, cell eating, and a prokaryote just can't do that. Its wall and membrane are too stiff.
Cannot do it. That flexible moving membrane driven by the cytoskeleton, that's the superpower. That's the key innovation that sets everything else in motion.
Okay, so flexibility first. Then what? Let's build the first eukaryote. Where did the nucleus come from?
Well, the thinking, based on Dr. Hoffman's lecture and molecular data, points to an ancestor that was probably an anaerobic archon. So from the archaea domain, not bacteria.
An archon. Okay. And it needed to protect its DNA, right?
Right. So the theory for the nucleus in the endoplasmic reticulum, the ER, is invagination. The cell's outer membrane start folding inwards.
Folding in around the DNA region, the nucleoid.
Exactly. Folding in around the nucleoid. And what's cool is that this theory perfectly explains something we see in our cells right now.
Which is?
The nuclear envelope. The membrane around the nucleus isn't just one layer thick. It's two.
Ah, because of the fold? You take a single sheet, fold it over itself to make a pocket, you get two layers?
You got it. It's like a fossil of that folding event. And crucially, that outer nuclear membrane is still continuous with the ER, which is itself just this huge network of folded membranes filling the cell.
Okay, so the blueprint, the DNA, is now secure inside this double-membraned nucleus. But a blueprint needs power to build anything complex.
Now we get to the energy revolution. Endosymbiosis. One organism living inside another.
This is where the mitochondria come in.
Yes. So our early anaerobic eukaryote ancestor, using its new flexible membrane, engulfs an aerobic bacterium, a bacterium that uses oxygen.
But instead of digesting it...
It survives. The bacterium survives inside the host cell and just keeps doing its thing.
Yeah.
Aerobic respiration, making energy using oxygen.
Yeah.
Hold on. If the host was anaerobic, didn't use oxygen, wasn't bringing in this oxygen-using machine kind of... Well, dangerous. Oxygen can be toxic.
That's a really good point. It must have been a tricky transition.
Yeah.
But the payoff, the sheer amount of ATP energy this new internal power plant could generate, must have quickly outweighed the risks. That engulfed bacterium became the first mitochondrion, and bam, the host is now an aerobic powerhouse.
And Dr. Hoffman laid out some really compelling evidence for this. It's not just a neat story.
Oh yeah, the evidence is overwhelming. Dr. Hoffman listed about five key things. First, mitochondria just look like bacteria, shape-wise.
Okay.
Second, they have two membranes. The outer one came from the host cell when it engulfed the bacterium like a wrapper. The inner one is the bacterium's original membrane.
Makes sense.
Third, they have their own DNA. And it's circular, just like bacterial DNA, totally separate from the linear DNA in our nucleus.
Wow, okay.
Fourth, they have their own ribosomes to build proteins, and these ribosomes look like bacterial ribosomes, not eukaryotic ones.
And the fifth?
They reproduce inside our cells by binary fission. They just split in two, exactly like free-living bacteria do. Put it all together. It's undeniable history.
So that's the mitochondrion. What about chloroplasts? The things that let plants photosynthesize? Same idea.
Same idea, but it happened later. A cell that already had mitochondria engulfed another bacterium. This time, a photosynthetic one, like a cyanobacterium.
And that became the first chloroplast.
Exactly. And all the same lines of evidence apply. Double membranes, circular DNA, bacterial ribosomes, binary fission. It works for chloroplasts, too.
So that single event engulfing a photosynthesizer, that's the big split. Our lineage, the Uniconta, we just got the mitochondria, but the plant lineage and others, they got both.
That's the key branching point created by these two major endosymbiotic events. First, mitochondria, then later, in one lineage, chloroplasts.
And Dr. Hoffman mentioned it didn't even stop there. Secondary endosymbiosis.
Yeah, briefly. You can get situations where a eukaryotic cell that already has chloroplasts gets engulfed by another eukaryote. So you end up with chloroplasts wrapped in three or even four membranes. It's like Russian dolls of symbiosis.
Evolution by eating each other, basically. Okay, let's put this on a timeline. Dr. Hoffman broke eukaryotic history into three eras.
Yeah, it helps to see the scale. Starts way back, 1.8 billion years ago. First is the emergence. That's when the first eukaryotes appeared. But for a long time, not much happened diversification-wise. They were all unicellular, pretty simple, complex cells.
Okay, emergence. 1.8 billion years ago, then?
Then comes the Age of Novelties. This runs from about 1.3 billion years ago up to maybe 600 million years ago. This is where the new machinery, the mitochondria and chloroplasts, really got tuned up. Eukaryotic photosynthesis and respiration became efficient. We also see the beginnings of multicellularity here, though organisms were still small. And critically, things like sexual reproduction evolved, shuffling genes around. It was about refining the toolkit.
Refining the toolkit to set up the big show.
Exactly. Which brings us to the Age of Hugeness, from 600 million years ago until now. This is where things really take off. Large organisms appear. The big groups we know, animals, plants, fungi, they finally emerge and diversify like crazy, using that toolkit perfected in the previous age.
Now, to really understand that diversification, Dr. Hoffman emphasized, we need to talk about the protests.
Ah, yes, the protests.
Yeah.
They are basically everything else. They show the most incredible variety of forms.
The definition Dr. Hoffman gave is simple. A protest is any eukaryote that is not an animal, plant, or fungus.
Simple definition, but it creates a real classification headache. Because by excluding animals, plants, and fungi, which descended from protest ancestors.
The group isn't a true evolutionary lineage. It's paraphyletic. It leaves out some descendants.
Right. It's not a proper clade or monophyletic group. But we're kind of stuck with the term. Same issue with algae, actually.
Algae just means any photosynthetic protest, right? Also paraphyletic.
Yep. And these organisms, protists and algae, they're scattered across all the major eukaryotic supergroups. Dr. Hoffman showed Excavata, Sar, Archaeplastida, and our own group, Uniconta.
Let's talk about Uniconta then, since that's us animals and fungi too. Dr. Hoffman highlighted our connection to choanoflagellates.
Yes, this is fascinating. Choanoflagellates are these tiny, single-celled or colonial protists. And if you look at one under a microscope,
it looks almost identical to a specific cell type in sponges, the simplest animals, the collar cells or choanocytes.
Exactly. The resemblance is uncanny. It's strong evidence they're our closest living single-celled relatives. But there's a crucial difference.
What's the difference that makes us animals and them not?
It comes down to protein domains. Animals have something called the CCD domain in key proteins. Think of it like molecular Velcro.
Velcro.
Yeah, it allows cells to stick together really strongly and specifically. It's essential for building complex, stable, multicellular tissues and bodies. Choanoflagellates lack this CCD domain.
So they can form simple colonies? Maybe. But not true integrated tissues like animals. That one protein change makes all the difference.
It seems to be a fundamental innovation for animal multicellularity.
And speaking of Uniconta strangeness, what about slime molds? Dr. Hoffman showed them switching lifestyles.
Oh, slime molds are wild. They totally blur the line between single-celled and multicellular. When food's around, they cruise as individual amoebas, little solitary hunters.
But when times get tough.
They send out chemical signals, aggregate by the thousands, and form this giant, coordinated, moving, slug-like thing, a multicellular blob. This blob crawls around, finds a good spot, and then transforms again into a stalk with spores on top to disperse and find new feeding grounds. It's incredible coordination.
Okay, switching gears from our group, let's look at the SAR clade. Dr. Hoffman mentioned diatoms.
Diatoms. Tiny, yes, but incredibly important.
Yeah.
They're single-celled algae living inside these beautiful, intricate little boxes made of silica, glass houses, essentially.
What tiny jewels.
Yeah.
And they're major producers in the ocean.
Hugely important. They form a massive part of the phytoplankton base, doing a ton of photosynthesis globally.
Also in SAR, the brown algae, like kelp.
Right, the giants of the algae world. Some kelp forests are like underwater redwood forests.
Yeah.
But Dr. Hoffman made a key point. They look like plants, but it's superficial.
How so?
They have structures that resemble roots, stems, and leaves. But the root is just a holdfast for anchoring. The stem is a stipe. They don't have true vascular tissues like plants do for transporting water and nutrients internally. It's convergent evolution, looking similar due to similar needs.
Got it. And one more group, Archaeoplastida, home of the red algae.
Red algae, yeah. We might know them best as nori, the stuff used for sushi rubbers.
Ah, okay. Why are they red?
Their red pigments are really good at absorbing blue and green light, and blue light penetrates deepest in the ocean. So these pigments allow red algae to photosynthesize much deeper underwater than green algae or plants, whose chlorophyll mostly grabs red and blue light, which disappears faster.
So the color is a deep water adaptation.
Clever. Very clever. It lets them occupy a niche others can't reach.
Okay, so we've seen this incredible diversity spring from those early symbiotic events. Let's talk ecological impact. Producers are key.
Absolutely fundamental. Those microscopic algae, the phytoplankton like diatoms, along with photosynthetic bacteria like cyanobacteria, they are the primary producers, the autotrophs. They form the base of pretty much all marine food webs. Everything else, the consumers, the heterotrophs, from tiny zooplankton up to giant whales, depends on them capturing solar energy.
Which makes that bad news slide Dr. Hoffman showed pretty concerning.
Yeah, that was sobering. Satellite data looking at ocean chlorophyll, basically the greenness of the ocean surface.
This is decline.
A decline in most ocean regions over recent decades. Fewer producers means less food for everything else, and it has huge implications for carbon cycling and climate, too. It's a worrying trend.
Beyond food webs, protests also get involved in really intricate relationships, right? Both good and bad.
Definitely. Think about termites. They eat wood, which is mostly cellulose, but they can't actually digest it themselves.
So how do they survive?
They have endosymbiotic protests living inside their gut, specialized protests that can break down cellulose into sugars, releasing glucose that both the protest and the termite can use. It's a classic mutualism.
One helps the other survive. Okay, that's the good side. What about the bad?
Parasitism. Dr. Hoffman gave the example of trypanosomes, which are in the excavata group. They cause devastating diseases like African sleeping sickness.
And their life cycle is complicated.
Insanely complicated. It requires two specific hosts to complete, a human and a tsetse fly, in the case of sleeping sickness. The parasite goes through different stages, multiplying inside human liver cells, then bursting out to infect red blood cells, causing illness. But the sexual part of its life cycle, where genetic recombination happens, can only occur inside the fly after it bites an infected human.
Wow, so it needs both hosts, switching between them, manipulating them. It really highlights the sophisticated, damaging interactions these simple eukaryotes are capable of.
Exactly. Complex life cycles, complex interactions, both beneficial and harmful.
So stepping back, we've covered, what, almost 2 billion years? From a flexible archaeon swallowing a bacterium leading to mitochondria.
Then another gulp leading to chloroplasts, setting the stage for plants.
Through the weirdness of slime molds and the beauty of diatoms, to the deep sea adaptations of red algae and these really complex parasitic cycles, it's quite a journey.
It really is. And I think the big takeaway from Dr. Hoffman's lecture is just how central these huge transformative leaps were.
Mm-hmm.
Complexity didn't just slowly... What might that tell us about the underlying genetic toolkit? The foundational abilities needed for complex life that consumes rather than produces its own energy.
Something to mull over. What shared history is hinted at by that animal-fungi connection. We'll leave you with that thought until our next deep dive.